Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
In 2020, events have yet again shone a light on racial inequalities across the globe. Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
I asked the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now. Not ever.
I mean,
these comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
Yeah, but I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Face of democracy, very good.
G'day, I'm Mark Kenny and this is Democracy Sausage Extra. And given that we're getting quite close to the end of a year and the end of this year and what a year it's been, I thought it would be good to do a little bit of a review, think about how all of these things have played out and particularly from the sort of political standpoint, what it tells us about where we are, what it tells us about the government, the opposition, some of the issues that have been running. And there's no better person to do that with than David Spears. He's been on this podcast before, of course. He's a multiple award winner, Walkley Award winner, Press Gallery Journalist of the Year, and these days, of course, host of Insiders on ABC. Welcome back, David.
G'day, Mark.
Great to have you on Democracy Sausage, as always. Look, let's just get straight into it here and talk about some of the main elements of this year from that political perspective. And I think the best place to start is to talk about Scott Morrison, how he's gone. And in a minute, we'll get onto his opponent, Anthony Albanese, as well. But just on Morrison, he's right at the moment, of course, in self-isolation in the lodge as we record this. Been attending Question Time on a video monitor, which has worked about as well as a lot of video conferencing has worked throughout the year for lots of us. You know, they eventually got on top of it. Quite an interesting year. Very little travel. He's done that one trip to Japan, which is why he was in isolation at the lodge. But for the rest of the year, it's been completely bizarre, of course. How do you think he's gone overall?
Look, I think it's fair to say he's finishing the year in a much stronger position than where he began. When we look at 2020, we have to, of course, go back to the bushfires and what a horrible summer that was, not only for the many Australians affected by it, but politically for Scott Morrison as well. There were real doubts about his famed political judgment, given his holiday in Hawaii and the way he carried himself when he came back and tried to recover ground. Then along comes COVID. And it has been, in a political sense, an opportunity for him to recover. And he's done more than that, hasn't he? I mean, look, there have clearly been mistakes along the way. And I think it is interesting to think back, reflect on what some of these mistakes were, and how he dealt with them as well has been interesting as well. I mean, early on, I think he misread the mood, sent the wrong message when he said he wanted to go to the footy, for example, and that really dominated for a little while there. He resisted the state border closures for a long time. He fought against the WA one in particular. He didn't think schools should be shut down. He resisted that strongly. His minister, Dan Tehan, was out there fighting the case very strongly. But I think in each of these cases, Morrison did end up either capitulating in the end or realising that he was on the wrong side of the public opinion on these things, or indeed the wrong side, in fact, of where Australia needed to be. So, yes, in some of these cases, and on the economic front as well. I mean, you could argue JobKeeper should have kicked in a couple of weeks earlier than it did. But in the end, he finally gets there, I think, with most of these things one way or another. And by any international comparison, Australia's done well on the health and the economic front. And I think for Scott Morrison, ultimately, that that leaves him looking a political winner. A lot of credit does have to go to the states, and we can get to that. But, you know, for a prime minister in this situation, there's no doubt that he will be judged to have done a pretty good job this year.
And the polls seem to be suggesting that's the case. He's got a very strong approval rating for a sitting prime minister, around 66%, I think I read the other day, whereas his opponent, Anthony Albanese, is in, much lower, down at about 28%, I think. So you normally have prime ministers ahead of opposition leaders when it comes to these sorts of things. It's this sort of resting normal, I guess you'd call it. But yeah, going back to some of those things you mentioned, it was a terrible start to the year. And we've made this point before on Democracy Sausage, but it was almost because of how disastrous politically was his Hawaii trip and his explanation of it, the fact they tried to keep it secret and repelled calls from journalists as to where the Prime Minister was and was it true that he was overseas and all these sorts of things. And, you know, he effectively snuck out of the country, not to put too fine a point on it, but normally when prime ministers travel, there are, statements issued to the media explaining that, but this had all been done surreptitiously and then it flared up, of course. He comes back, the bushfire situation is worse, and his failure to explain it, to his attitude, I don't hold a hose, mate, and all these sorts of things, did not go down well. So that part of it's a given, and you've already referred to that. But then Corona comes along, and it's almost because of how badly he's been wounded by the bushfire handling that there's a sense that you can almost see in Morrison, he's had a glimpse of his political mortality, and he knows he has to do better. He knows he has to show some real leadership. And there's a happy coincidence there that the country really needs some real leadership as well. And we get a bit of that from early on, notwithstanding, as you say, quite a number of areas in which he perhaps initially misstepped.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the capacity of Morrison to learn from the mistakes of the summer bushfires, this has been remarked on, in your podcast and elsewhere this year, that was quite something to observe. And I think a notable feature of Scott Morrison as Prime Minister. Not many Prime Ministers managed to learn from their mistakes, and this was a whopper, what happened with the Hawaii holiday and generally the handling of the bushfire response, a moment of national crisis that Australians do look to their national leader for comfort, security and leadership. And so the ability to learn from that was really quite notable, quite interesting, quite important in the story of Scott Morrison's prime ministership. And I think it did mean that he really threw everything into COVID when it came along. Yes, I noted some of the mistakes that he's made along the way here, but let's not forget, he was pretty prompt in declaring this to be a pandemic from Australia's point of view, well ahead of the World Health Organization or most other countries, shutting the border to travellers from China, and then, one
creating the national cabinet.
Yeah, all creating the national cabinet. I mean, these were all front foot initiatives from the prime minister that were important, unquestionably were important. And yes, he may have, you could argue he was dragged into JobKeeper, but he got there eventually. He is the leader of the government. They got there, and this was critical in protecting Australians through this. So, yes, credit where it's due for the way he's handled all of that. By all means, not perfect. And we can go to some of that, but you do need to acknowledge the seriousness, I suppose, with which he took COVID from an early point. That's in stark contrast to obviously Donald Trump at the other end of the spectrum, but even other leaders like Boris Johnson and plenty of other leaders who really quibbled, hesitated about how serious to take this global threat.
Yes, I think that's right. And the National Cabinet's a really important moment because although he did make a number of those mistakes on individual calls, and I think, as you said, the declaration of going to the footy was also quite egregious because it happened on a Friday that he was announcing that as from the following Monday there would be this prohibition on gatherings of more than 500 people. And yet in the interim he proudly proclaimed that he was going to be going to the footy and indeed encouraged other people, if you don't have a sniffle, go along to the footy as well, which was just a very mixed message. And he subsequently went to the footy again at some point.
The opposition was
on his side to begin with on that question, I might say.
Yeah, I think that really, I mean, he said something this week in Parliament in welcoming the good news on the economic growth that we saw for the September quarter. He indicated, and I think rightly, that the comeback, he said, is underway, is built on the strong public health responses that have been put in place all around the country. They were his words in Parliament this week, really, I think, giving credit to the states without saying as much, but all Australians, for getting it right on the health front. In other words, we all know this now. You can only have economic success with this pandemic if you confront and fix and suppress the health problem. That wasn't always Scott Morrison's approach, to be fair. I think going into this, and the footy moment was really an example of it, but there are plenty of others where he was overly concerned about the economic impact this would have on a lot of vulnerable Australians, his position on the schools, on the borders as well. This was all Scott Morrison really trying to protect as much of the economy as he could. And he copped a lot of flack at the time from those who thought he was, just trying to protect the economic figures so that the government wouldn't cop it down the track. But I do think it was genuine on his part that he was generally worried about, vulnerable Australians losing jobs and losing their position in the labour market, for quite some time, if not permanently. Now, I think where we sit now, we all know, we all understand, including the Prime Minister, that you really do need to tackle the virus first. Otherwise, your economy's not going to have a chance. Look at what's happening in Europe. Look at what's happened in the United States. Look at what's happened around the world. Where the virus comes back, if you don't keep it under control, your economy will ultimately suffer.
Yeah, and it was interesting that for a while, as you say, that this issue kind of teetered on the edge of falling into that political taxonomy, that problem that we have with climate change as an issue, for example, where one side takes one position and the other side takes another and never the twain shall meet. It was a bit like that. There was a sense that, on the left, there was favour to lockdowns and to, really, really strong action on the health front. And on the right, there was this sort of economy argument. We've seen that play out in the US, where everything got politicised, even around corona, around wearing masks and lockdowns and the like. And Australia could have gone that way because it was, as you pointed out before, quite a spirited debate about school closures. And Dan Tehan, I think even on your show on Insiders, got quite strong on that at one stage. So some of Morrison's ministers were playing a lot of hardball. And that's why I go back to the National Cabinet. I think it was important because it overlaid on the whole political situation a calming, cooperative effect. And to an extent, it inhibited Morrison in playing the normal sort of tough verbal politics that would get played. Some of his ministers did, but Morrison himself mostly stepped back from that kind of thing, and that kept the National Cabinet functional, and it kept, I think, the temperature of political exchange between the levels of government at a manageable level, and as such, we did get a number of those really, what we now know in hindsight to have been really critical decisions, mostly by state governments, but facilitated through that, as I say, that kind of more cooperative problem-solving approach to politics.
I think that's right. Look, there's a few points to make about this whole National Cabinet experience. I remember early in the year when Wuhan was shut down, and a lot of us were looking at that thinking, can you imagine shutting down an entire city like that, locking people in their homes? And we all were aghast that, the Chinese Communist Party was able to do this. No other country would be able to do that. Little did we know that this would hit us in the way that it did and that we would be compliant in similar shutdowns. And many might argue, in fact, in the Victorian case, certainly a more prolonged, in that sense, severe shutdown than even Wuhan went through. I don't think many would have expected that the Australian people would be willing to subject themselves. And yes, there are of course those at the fringes of the left and the right who didn't agree with it, and you know, made that clear and did silly things. But the vast bulk of Australians went along with this. I think a lot of the reason for that is what you touch on there, Mark. This confidence that was instilled by leaders coming together, putting politics to one side, state and federal, sitting around the table, going through in detail what you're allowed to do, what you weren't allowed to do, what was going to be closed and when, this cooperative approach. Now, having said that, I think a lot of us, myself included, probably invested too much hope that this new model, this new approach to national cooperative leadership might lead to breakthroughs on long overdue tax reform, federation reform, climate change action. I think we expected too much, given the reality of our political system, from this new national cabinet formulation. But it was important. It did the job in dealing with this pandemic. You're also right, though, to point out that we saw Morrison ministers let off the leash to go after the states, whether it was Dan Tehan on the schools front, where, don't forget, they even were threatening and I think in practice taking funding away from private schools where they could, that didn't keep their doors open. Peter Dutton let off the leash to go after Anastasia Palaszczuk over border closures in Queensland. Josh Frydenberg leading the charge against Dan Andrews in Victoria. So while Morrison kept his hands clean sitting around the National Cabinet table to a large extent, certainly his senior figures were let off the leash to go after the states.
Yes, and it's interesting that point you make about lockdowns and how severe they looked at the beginning and how we came to accept them. There's been a fair bit of commentary about that. What does it say about Australians that we were so compliant, so obedient? I think it wasn't so much obedience as a relatively high level of confidence in expertise. And I think most people could actually see the same evidence that the experts were being shown and were showing political leaders. And there was a shared commitment that we needed to sort of divide and separate, if I could put it like that, to stop the virus transmitting. And yes, we did have that early success, and I think that was important. Then we had the Victorian setback, and a very severe setback it was. But what a remarkably different situation we find ourselves in now. And it is showing up in, confidence in the federal government, confidence in the Prime Minister, even though you would say the heavy lifting of most of the measures in terms of getting on top of this virus have been imposed by the states.
They have.
And plenty of Morrison critics have been eager to point that out.
Yeah, they have. Look, another reason for the compliance with all of this, I think, is because of what we witnessed soon after the initial phase of the virus in Wuhan. What we witnessed in Italy in particular, and those scenes of the hospitals just unable to cope with the number of people requiring ventilators, the scenes of people dying on the scale that they were, I think the genuine fear of the virus had a big role to play in this.
Yeah.
The states, this has been the fascinating political story of the year as well, a reminder of how our federation works, a reminder that the states do have enormous power and that they're willing to use it, and that they're willing to certainly capitalise on the political benefit of using that power as well. It's been a reminder, I think, not just to Australians but to the Morrison government as well. As I suggested earlier, with the border closures, don't forget that the Morrison government was joining in on the Clive Palmer appeal against WA's border closure there for a while.
Yeah.
It rapidly changed course when it realised it was very much on the wrong side of this politically, and backed right out of that High Court case. So, these border closures, the heavy restrictions that have been imposed in some jurisdictions, certainly where I am in Victoria, the states were able to do this. They did it. And you can argue that it absolutely worked. I can tell you the popularity figures for Dan Andrews are now enormous in this state. And a lot of that has to do with the situation we're now in, where, as we speak, the virus has been eliminated in Victoria. So I think all that hard work that people have done, they now acknowledge it was worth it.
Yes, they do. Although I was moving around Parliament House yesterday and talking to a number of senior Victorian members of the government, and they are still very strong on this argument that went on too long, and that the tail of it in terms of mental health presentations and other other health complications or conditions that went untreated or undetected in some cases, that there's a very sort of large hidden cost or legacy cost of this lockdown that is yet to be paid by a lot of people.
Yeah, and look, there are still questions about, let's be frank, the failures that were evident in the early stage, the failures that led to this second wave, hotel quarantine, and perhaps the bigger one, the failure of adequate contact tracing in Victoria. Look, these problems have now been addressed, we are told, and we're certainly seeing that in the evidence of the daily results and the good news. But, there are still questions about all of that and, how scientifically based some of the decisions around curfews in the evening and mask wearing outside and all these things that perhaps, you could argue did stay in for longer or shouldn't have been in place at all. But by and large, the measures work. And I can tell you, Victorians, myself included, didn't think we'd get to the point of having zero cases, maybe one day here or there, but not for, a month. We wouldn't reach this point of elimination. And I do think there needs to be credit where it's due for Dan Andrews in weathering a lot of pressure, let's not forget, during the height of this political standoff to stick to his guns and see it out.
It's a very good point because it's kind of the difference. It's a popularity that he may now have and indeed had before going through this process. There's been a fair bit of support for Dan Andrews as a premier, but the decision to hold that lockdown and to do it so strongly and for so long was the opposite of populism. It was not an easy decision to take. It was not an easy decision to maintain. And he fronted the media every day through that whole period. It was really quite extraordinary to watch politics and public policy playing out in such a way was really something quite novel in Australia. And as you say, it looks like voters are now rewarding the government for that,
they are. I think Dan Andrews though is also a master politician, and while he did front the daily press conference, exhausted questions, he'd be up there for an hour or more every day. He was also the master at not answering some very legitimate, straightforward, basic questions. I mean, still to this day, the fact that the government can't answer who made decisions around its own decisions around using private security and hotel quarantine is quite staggering, let's face it, that a government can't answer, how it functioned on a critical moment like that. But look, yes, he weathered that political pressure. Certainly it was piled on from the business community and the federal government, from Josh Frydenberg in particular. And I think right now he certainly, still will be criticised for business for going too hard, too long. But the general public, I think, are very much behind him right now.
Let's just take a very quick break and be back in a moment.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, let's go across the political divide and look at the situation facing Labor, which is federally, that is, which is a slightly more troubling one for the Labor Party. There is growing talk around the place about the leadership of Anthony Albanese, whether he's going to survive, whether he should survive, whether Labor has a realistic chance of winning the next election, which could come within 12 months. It may not come till 2022, but it's there's a wide expectation that it's likely toward the in the second half of 2021. So What do you think? Is Albanese in a difficult spot now, David, as a result of COVID and as a result of the way other issues are playing out, things like climate change?
I think opposition leaders are always in a difficult spot, and that's no different for Anthony Albanese. But perhaps if we just look back at 2020 for this particular opposition leader at this particular time, look, I probably give more credit to Anthony Albanese than some other commentators here. This was always going to be an incredibly tough balancing act for an opposition leader to show national cooperation during an unprecedented crisis on the health and economic front, not to undermine the sort of messages that were needed to be delivered and needed to be responded to by the Australian community, not to undermine that confidence essentially in the whole national cabinet process. But at the same time, hold the government to account where it needed to be held to account. And I do think Albanese deserves credit on a couple of fronts. Yes, he did support in large part the government's decisions, the decisions around closures, the decisions around rolling out support, and made sure all of that passed through Parliament rapidly. But he did hold them to account on a few things. He called on them to do the JobKeeper package or some sort of wage subsidy package earlier than they did it. He called out, and I should have touched on this earlier, the aged care failure of the Morrison government as well, and really highlighted and I think put a lot of pressure on the government to lift its game in relation to what we were seeing in aged care, which was clearly a federal government responsibility and failing during this crisis. There are other issues along the way like RoboDebt and so on that Bill Shorten have highlighted, but related to this pandemic, I think Anthony Albanese by and large did probably as well as any opposition leader could during a period like this. Yes, there's still going to be pressure to come in the recovery phase about how to get that right. And we can argue, about whether Labor's struck the right balance there. But I do think in large part, he probably did strike more or less the right tone in pressuring the government at the same time as providing that cooperation that was vital. Moving into next year, yes, I do think he is going to face increasing pressure if Labor's primary vote in particular, that's the number to watch, remains as low as it has been now for quite some time. Already there's talk about other options, other possibilities, who might be able to do a better job, but I don't think there's a clear answer to any of that just yet. And I think the next few months, usually a quiet time in politics though, can still be a really testing time for an opposition leader. How he performs over the next few months, I think, will really be critical as to his survival.
Yeah, you're right. It's a sort of by definition an insecure job. It's often described as the worst job in, or the hardest job in politics, being the federal opposition leader, particularly so during a time of national crisis of an exogenous threat like this, the opposition has really played the Team Australia game of getting in, being supportive, not being unnecessarily divisive about things. As you say, was quite critical in some of the quite important in some of the key decisions that have been taken, including JobKeeper, which is arguably, as has been pointed out by numerous people, it's the single greatest injection of cash the Commonwealth has ever done in Australia's history. So it was something Labor was calling for some time, and the the government at that point was initially saying that it was inappropriate, it was not the right way to go, and then it eventually went down that path. And the same could be said for job seeker, for having a job seeker allowance. So yes, that's it. You don't get a lot of points, it seems, for being constructive, but the nation really needed that level of constructiveness,
and you don't get the attention. That's the issue. You don't get any attention really during a long period of this year. There's just not that much interest in what the opposition thinks. He was denied a seat at the national cabinet table. He wasn't making these really important decisions that Australians were tuning in for. People paid attention to their premiers more than they've ever paid attention to these people, not to mention the Prime Minister as well. And that just makes it a very tough environment for any opposition leader to get any sort of cut through.
Yes. Now, one of the, the political orthodoxy, one of the orthodoxies that's been circulating around Canberra is that, yes, but after the crisis has passed, there'll still be the long economic tail from this crisis. When the government's dealing with, you know, high unemployment and, you know, business failures and the like, you know, the political mood will change. Now, even that is quite difficult to see at this stage. The Reserve Bank admits that unemployment will probably stay higher than is desirable for longer, and that wages will remain flat, which is, you know, has been a sort of a blight on the Australian economy for some time now. But we're also seeing quite significant recovery in the economy. So even the background conditions that might give an opposition, you know, some fertile ground to work with in terms of, you know, criticising the government, even that's actually perhaps not working to the opposition's favour.
Yeah, I think there clearly have been mistakes from Anthony Albanese as well this year. One of them, I think, was the juvenile attempt to label the recession the Morrison recession. I just think that sort of missed the mark, and they probably dropped off. Well, we're technically now out of recession anyway, but I think they've dropped off using that phrase as much. But I think Labor and Anthony Albanese would be far better now, and certainly in the early months of next year, to start articulating ahead of the May budget what sort of reforms Australia needs to see if we are to build back better or stronger or better than, you know, we were heading into this pandemic. This has been the great argument of Labor in the big picture, has been that, well, you know, all of this debt and this economic crisis, you can't just blame on the pandemic. Yes, the main reason we're in this crisis is because of the pandemic, but in Labor's view, there were these problems after so many years of the coalition government that have left vulnerable workers in insecure work. I think Labor really needs to get in the game now because we could be less than 12 months out from an election and explaining how we do need to reform the economy, to fix these problems of insecure work, to fix these problems of vulnerable workers not getting a fair deal. Now is the time, I think, to start laying that out. The government, its response to this pandemic has really been about emergency support, JobKeeper, JobSeeker, even the tax breaks and investment incentives for business in the budget. We're yet to really see lasting reform come from the government, and I think even a reluctance to go down that path. Even the industrial relations changes we'll see next week, I don't think are going to be, you know, what you would call major reform, perhaps not really much reform at all. Labor needs to get back into that game. And, I know there are some burnt fingers after last year's election. We're going too far on some of the tax reform fronts, but I don't think they can abandon the field, particularly given what's happened over the last 12 months. Now's the time to start talking about that reform.
Yeah, it's a very good point. Sally McManus from the ACTU was making a similar point yesterday, not directly, but very much highlighting a point you just made about how the pandemic, how the crisis has exposed weaknesses in the economy, particularly a lot of insecure work, the casualisation of so many areas of the economy, and how vulnerable that has made people feel. And vulnerability is not it's not an ideal political background condition for a government to win. So there is probably some space for Labor to really get back to TORS there, to get back to its very much its most fundamental values in terms of protecting employment rights for people in particularly low income brackets. The other area, of course, is climate change. Now, climate change is the dynamics of this have changed quite dramatically. It certainly feels that way as a result of the end of the Trump administration, Biden's coming in, taking the US back into the Paris Accord, appointing John Kerry as global envoy on climate. This has induced some panic, it seems to me, in the commentariat in some places. Do you think this will embolden Labor to more quickly get back to naming its 2030, 2035 targets? Do you think it was even as important an issue at the last election as some would say?
You think it should. You'd think it should give them a bit more courage, at least, to finalise a plan. I think politically it probably wouldn't be a bad idea to settle on a position and stop the freelancing from those who are arguing for and against 2030 or 2035, as would, I think, be more likely, interim targets. We know their position on 2050, net zero. Albanese, great, was very quick out of the blocks, I think, in his leadership in seeing where the global movement was on this, and indeed all the states and territories, business groups and so on, everyone's behind it except the Morrison government, it seems. So I think he was, you know, very deft in moving on that promptly. But I do think it would probably help in the new year to settle what the interim position is for Labor, and indeed the mechanism, how they intend to achieve any of these targets, because otherwise the public debate will continue. And I do think that's, you know, been one of the vulnerabilities, one of the soft spots for Albanese and for Labor this year, no doubt about it. Look, there's no doubt that we are in a moment now, and probably the best moment in, you know, some 5 years, when it comes to encouraging science for action on climate change. The election of Biden, his appointment of John Kerry, the positioning that we're seeing from Boris Johnson, you know, China as well, a willingness to embrace a 2060 net zero target, other countries, Japan and so on, getting on board with the 2050. So, yes, the momentum feels like it's there right now. And you do see the signs from Morrison as well that he's positioning to shift, maybe even to supporting the net zero by 2050 target himself before the next election. Some in his ranks think he will do that. We'll see. But yes, I do think Anthony Albanese needs to stay ahead of this debate and probably settle the position within his own ranks. Wouldn't be a bad idea.
Look, just before we leave Albanese, Labor is staring down the barrel of a fourth straight loss. Mm. That's a pretty chilling thing for any party of government to consider, to contemplate. That does really make it very serious. When you put it like that, if they are not in a position in the early part of next year, let's say in the first quarter of next year, they're not making headway, does the party stick with Anthony Albanese? I know the rules have changed, which supposedly make it harder to replace a leader and so forth, but it's a pretty chilling prospect, the idea of and when you think about it, this is the same party in government, I'm talking about the coalition now, the same party that in 2013-14 produced that stinker of a budget and which had all those other problems, you know, right through Choppergate, and there have been so many scandals that have happened with this government. And yet this same party has been continuously in power ever since then, since 2013. And the numbers don't look very favourable for Labor now in terms of winning that election. As you say, things can change. I'm wondering what's your guess about whether the Labor Party caucus will stick with the leader or panic and make a change?
Yeah, you're right to highlight the longevity of this coalition government, the length of time and the number of elections that Labor's been in the wilderness on the opposition benches. I mean, there was a moment this week in Parliament when up in the public gallery there sat Joe Hockey. He was visiting for the day. And it was just a little reminder that, and you mentioned that 2014 budget there, the horror budget that, you know, set in train, really what led to the demise of Tony Abbott and Joe Hockey and so on. But a little reminder of just how long they have been in power for. It just feels like a lifetime ago. Labor, you're right, can't really afford another election loss. Those who say, Jim Chalmers should sit it out, bro. You know, they're heading to lose this election. He's better off waiting for, you know, a chance when they might win. I just think that sort of defeatist thinking is really problematic for a party that's lost three elections on the trot. If they're really thinking about throwing away a fourth with a view to, you know, protecting their best assets for a go at the fifth, yes, you've lost a generation of Labor talent sitting in opposition there who'll never have a shot at the time in the ministry. What will the Labor caucus do? I'm always loath to guess where a party might go with these things. It is very hard to know. I wouldn't write Anthony Albanese off, as some have. I think this has been, as I mentioned earlier, a really tough year for any opposition leader. I do think the next few months, the first few months of next year are going to be critical in terms of how he sets the party up, whether he shows any boldness when it comes to economic reform, whether he is willing to throw everything at trying to win this election, because Scott Morrison won't be easy to beat. We can say that with certainty. And whether the party judges that Anthony Albanese is the best bet to go up against him, or whether they'd be better with someone else, whether a woman in particular might be a much tougher opponent for the likes of Scott Morrison than another, you know, middle-aged bloke, I just wonder whether there are going to be hard heads there who do think about what is going to be the best option to try and bring down a pretty popular prime minister.
And that would take the right of the Labor Party, because that woman would be Tanya Plibersek, and that would take the right of the party making a decision that seems unlikely, I would have thought. Abandoning the right for, you know, like going to another left-wing candidate.
Yeah, the concern about Tanya Plibersek would be, how does she win back Queensland? She's another left-wing MP from a neighbouring seat to Anthony Albanese. So, you know, what are you really getting? I hear all of that. And, you know, the talk about a Tanya Plibersek, Jim Chalmers partnership, you know, is one that's quietly muttered in no particular order, leader or deputy leader. That would have to be sorted out. But one can help in Queensland, the other might, you know, wrong foot Scott Morrison. So I just think facing a female opponent would be a particular challenge for Scott Morrison right now. But, you know, there's no perfect candidate. That's the bottom line. And that probably works in Anthony Albanese's favour right now. But, you know, if he can get moving in the next few months of next year with a recovery in the sales of the Australian economy, that's the time to really start laying out how he would do things differently and exciting the Australian public about an alternative future.
It's really interesting the situation Labor finds itself in, though, because if you think about, I mean, you know, we've been talking about the low poll standing of Labor, but think about what's happened over this year. We've had elections in the Northern Territory, in the ACT, and in Queensland, and Labor governments have been re-elected in all three. In Queensland, as you say, it's the real problem child for Labor federally, but it's re-elected a Labor government there, you know, quite decisively. So, they can take some comfort from that, but as you say, a lot of it comes down to Labor's primary vote federally. That primary vote languishing in the low to mid-30s is just not enough to win government.
No, and look, you know, Australians, and I think Queenslanders in particular, have shown over many years their willingness to discern between state and federal, to vote one way at a state level, another federally. Peter Beattie ruled for a long time while John Howard was in federally. So it doesn't easily translate into federal success for Labor in Queensland. And don't forget Anastasia Palaszczuk, too, repositioned very swiftly on the Adani mine, approved another coal mine. So that would be a more difficult thing, I think, for Anthony Albanese to show pro-coal credentials in the way that Palaszczuk did. But, you know, look, it's possible for him. It's just tough. It's really tough in the political environment. Economy in recovery. Morrison seen, rightly or wrongly, but I think seen to have done a good job this year in handling this whole crisis. It is going to be difficult for him, and I think not an election, whenever it is, that he can be timid about. I think boldness is going to be required if Labor's to have any chance.
All right. Now, just one final topic, China. It's the mega problem of the end of this year, it seems. The relationship with our major trading partner is, just going further and further south. The war of words continuing. How do you think that will play out politically?
Politically, I think there's nothing but support for a tougher and tougher line or response to China's bullying and intimidation, which is what it is. I think you're going to have business leaders, you're going to have those in industries directly affected, like winemakers, barley growers and so on, who will complain that Australia's got it wrong, that our rhetoric's been over the top, that we didn't need to go as hard as we had on things like calling for an inquiry into the virus and so on, that's cost them in their hip pocket, which it, you know, arguably has. But I do think generally the public is very much behind, and it is bipartisan, the position Australia is taking in response to all of this, that we're not going to back down, we're not going to concede on any of these 14 grievances that China has with Australia. And clearly this week's quite offensive tweet from the Chinese Foreign Ministry in regards to the Australian soldier backfired. If the aim here was to in any way sway the Australian public on this, it really did go right to the heart of what is often regarded as a national reverence for the soldier and so on. So I don't think public opinion is softening at all on this, quite the opposite. That doesn't mean, politically, sure, he might be on a winner here, Scott Morrison, but that doesn't mean in a policy sense or a national interest sense this is going to be a winner for him at all. I think things are going to become even more difficult with China in 2021. And the way out of this is completely unclear to me. And I don't think a lot of strategic thinkers do have many easy answers as to how to fix this problem. It's going to hurt us more on an economic front. And it is clearly having to require a rethink on our strategic positioning as well. So this will remain one of the big national problems, I think, as we head into next year.
Yes, I notice. I mean, as you say, it's very hard to see how it's going to be resolved. The lines of dialogue are simply not open at the moment. Ministers aren't talking to their counterparts. The Prime Minister's not talking to his counterpart. Or not able to talk is the more accurate way to put it. I noticed that the Prime Minister tried to explain Australia's position on WeChat, and that has been blocked in China, the Chinese saying that they felt that it was potentially confusing for Chinese readers. So their commitment to any sort of balance in this seems to be, zero at the moment. So, yes, it's a bleak situation, and it does have quite significant economic implications for Australia, but at this stage it remains strongly bipartisan. David, thanks so much for spending some time talking to us about the overall situation in Australia, the political year that has been 2020, and we'll look forward to talking to you again in 2021, which is coming on us much faster than we thought.
An absolute pleasure, Mark. Thank you, and a very happy Christmas and New Year.
Thank you very much. Cheers, David. And that's Democracy Sausage for this week. Look forward to talking to you again next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.